Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Ambassadors in Chains. I'm Shane Ruther, and I'm here once again with my compadre, Rusty Fennell, and we are in the midst of discussing Rusty's book, Out of Egypt, and also diving into addiction and the things that addiction causes and brings. And so we're kind of right now calling this an extended series. And as a podcast, now that, you know, Rusty's been with me, let's see, I think we're on our seventh podcast together, because Dan and I did a couple in the beginning, and we're at 10, so this would be our eighth podcast together, I think. So we were just sitting here discussing where we're headed forward, how we're heading forward in the future, and what our plans are. And so as a podcast, with Rusty being with me only a short time so far, we're still kind of getting our feet under us and figuring out, you know, exactly where we're headed with this and how it's going to go. And we like the direction right now, and I hope you do too. And so let's dive into this one. Today we are moving into talking about the loss of thinking, which is something that happens in addiction. Your mind kind of turns off, and the addiction runs the show. And anyway, so that's what we've got for you today. So we'll get started here in a second. Well, Rusty, how's your week been?
This has been a really busy week, but it's good to be here today, and it's good to address this subject.
It is.
So I just want to ask you a question right as we begin.
Okay.
Have you ever touched a hot stove?
I have.
How many times?
Recently, actually. One time in that period of time. Yeah, I didn't touch it again immediately, no.
So touching a hot stove is an incredible learning experience.
It is.
Because once you do it once, you do not do it again intentionally.
No.
You might accidentally do it, but there's never an intentional reason to ever touch a hot stove again. No. And it's usually a lesson we learn very early in age.
Yes.
And really, what I want to talk about today is this whole idea of decision-making and how we learn through decision-making. Because it's every one of us learns through decision making. We have choices that we make. And as we make those choices, we learn the things that we like, the things that we don't like. We learn the things that we enjoy and the things we don't enjoy. We learn things that are beneficial to us. We learn things that are harmful to us. We learn good and bad. We learn right and wrong. And we usually learn those because of the choices we make and the benefits that come from good choices and the consequences that come with bad choices. And that's an extremely important aspect of all of our lives. It's basically how we learn. We go through life and we're making choices. And we eat, you know, cooked spinach and, you know, we decide we don't like cooked spinach.
Right.
Or we eat pizza and we decide we like pizza. Yeah, you know, we're making choices like this throughout our lives on a regular basis. And when we have the freedom to choose the things that we want to do and the things that we don't want to do, when we have the freedom to choose the decisions we make throughout the day, those choices inform us and guide us, and they lead us. And that's extremely important because, as I said, that's part of the learning process.
Okay.
Well, when those choices are taken away, then we struggle because we don't have the opportunity to actually learn in those decisions. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you were to have asked me when I was 16, Rusty, do you like sushi? I could not have told you whether I did or not, because one, growing up in Longview at that time, there just weren't, you know, a whole lot of sushi restaurants around. That's just, right, you know, the reality.
Yep.
And two, even if there had been, I wasn't controlling where we ate at that point in my life. My parents were, and there was no way they were going to a sushi restaurant. So I couldn't have told you because I didn't know.
Right.
And oftentimes when we've never had choices to make, then we don't know. But what if choices are taken away permanently?
Scary thought.
Yes, because when choices are taken away permanently, other people are making those choices for us.
Right.
And, you know, if you look at the children of Israel and Egypt, and, you know, we talked about this some, but the Israelites aren't choosing when they wake up. They're not choosing when they go to sleep. They're not choosing what they eat. They're not choosing where they work. All of those choices are being made for them. Now, the same is true with the addict. And we may say, wait a second now, the addict chose to use.
Yeah.
Well, yes, he did. But this is where part of understanding how the limbic system works and part of understanding how the brain works and how those choices were originally made and why those choices, even though they are actually harmful, were originally reinforced. So just briefly, let's talk about the limbic system. We talked about it a couple episodes ago, but it's important to understand that the limbic system is only concerned about three things: food, safety, and sex.
Right.
And the limbic system does not understand long-term consequences because the limbic system only operates in the present.
Okay. I remember.
So when something creates fear, if there is a behavior that I engage in that reduces my fear, the limbic system reinforces that behavior. That's a good behavior. That's a good choice. If something, if I'm getting extremely hungry and, you know, I eat or drink something that satisfies that hunger and thirst, the limbic system rewards that. Okay.
And you said the limbic system has a name. You called it the reptilian.
Sometimes called the brain. Reptilian brain, sometimes called the survival brain.
So it's a primitive.
Sometimes called the midbrain. It's very, it's deep with, if you were to look at our brain in a 3D scan or something like that, it's the deepest part and of the brain, and it's right there where the brainstem connects to the major brain.
Is the limbic system where the fight or flight response comes from?
Or well, that's actually controlled by the neurotransmitters in our brain.
Okay.
But those fight or flight behaviors can reinforce actions or can reinforce the behavior of the limbic system.
Right. Okay.
So let's set up a scenario. You've got a 12-year-old living in a house where mom and dad argue all the time. They're constantly arguing. They're constantly fighting. They're constantly yelling and screaming at each other. And that 12-year-old has a 16-year-old brother. And you're freaking out when mom and dad argue. You're freaking out when mom and dad fight. But your 16-year-old brother gives you a joint. It says, man, smoke this. You smoke it. Immediately, or almost immediately, what do you begin to feel?
Pleasure. Relaxation.
Relaxation. The anxiety goes away. The fear goes away.
Right.
So the limbic system says, ah, good behavior. Good choice. Now, the limbic system really doesn't understand that maybe the headache that comes later on or the fuzzy-mindedness that comes later on, that doesn't compute for the limbic system.
Yeah.
This child was in constant chronic stress from his parents always arguing, and marijuana helped him relax. Good behavior, good choice reinforces that behavior. Let's consider another person. You've got a 16-year-old. Deals with self-esteem issues, deals with insecurity issues, has dealt with self-esteem and insecurity all of his life. He goes to a party. He feels like he's the fly on the wall. He feels like he doesn't fit in. He feels like he doesn't belong. And someone gives him some alcohol. And suddenly, everything is great. Everything is wonderful.
The courage goes up. He starts talking to people. It becomes the laugh of the party.
That's exactly right. So he went from this sense of incredible fear and insecurity to this place of safety. Limbic system says, ah, reinforces that behavior. So suddenly, because, and this almost always happens in constant chronic stress, when the limbic system is under this sense of constant fear, and these behaviors bring immediate relief to that fear, that those behaviors get strongly reinforced. And so, yes, at one point, the alcoholic, at one point, the drug addict, made the choice. he made the choice to use. But this incredibly powerful cycle begins to take place, because in most situations, the drinking, the drug using creates more problems, more stress, more trouble. But the limbic system doesn't understand the drinking causing that. That's what's happening in our prefrontal cortex. That's what's happening in our brain, that, you know, in our consciousness, we're realizing that those behaviors the consequences of those behaviors are caused by the drinking. But in the limbic system, no, drinking's still good, because drinking takes away the immediate sense of stress. So it's this vicious cycle that's constantly reinforcing itself.
Yeah. Now, this might be a question, this might be the wrong question for this particular moment, but I'm taking the viewpoint of the listener and questions they may be asking. So I'm curious myself, why is it that some people can drink beer or alcohol or whatever, or smoke a joint and not go haywire with it and just totally, you know, that's all they want, or that they become a massive addict because of it? And some people do. Does that have anything to do with the limbic system there, or is it a different area that we're talking about?
It does have some to do with the limbic system. It has some to do with genetics. I can give you another example. How can someone smoke for 50 years and one day just drop cigarettes and never smoke again?
Yeah.
And how can somebody else who smoked cigarettes for 50 years try to stop and it literally feel like he's coming out of his skin and, you know, wants to kill people?
Right.
And some of it is genetics. We know that there are certain people that are genetically have a genetic predisposition I'll give you an example, alcohol especially.
Okay.
There's now been studies that show that there are certain people that convert alcohol to sugar, their bodies convert alcohol to sugar faster, which means that they don't have hangovers like other people do. So drinking doesn't have as negative a consequence for them as for others. And surprise, surprise, those people are much more likely to become alcoholics because of that. Yeah. That's an example of that genetic aspect of it.
Yeah. Aren't there certain groups, I'm not going to name any, but aren't there certain groups that have an allergy to alcohol, and it affects them differently than other, like, racial groups of people? Isn't that true? Or is that not true? I'm just curious. You hear that, you know.
Well, I know in certain ethnic groups there are, the best one I can think of is lactose intolerance, which has nothing to do with alcoholism, but
yeah.
We're still talking
about genetics,
yes,
here, but
certain cultures have a much greater problem with lactose intolerance than other ethnic groups do.
Huh.
So there is some genetic biology there. I'm not seeing a lot of research on alcoholism and drug abuse there. There was an old fashioned alcohol remedy back in the day that used that technique.
Really?
Because basically what they do is they would take alcoholics and they would lace all their drinks with Ipecac.
Ooh.
And they would force these alcoholics to drink them.
For those of you that don't know, Ipecac is a medication they can give you to make you puke.
Yes, and that's what would happen. They would drink the alcohol, and they would throw up violently.
Oh.
Then they get another drink, and they'd throw up violently. And it's an old behaviorism drink. You link drinking to being sick, and that stops people from drinking.
Pavlovian.
Yes, it's a very Pavlovian thing right there. There's also a medicine that you can be on today that if you take it, you basically cannot drink alcohol.
Well, because, same with cigarettes. Chantix makes you feel bad. I'm not sure.
Yes.
I've never taken it, but I mean, I've known people that have, and it mm-hmm. definitely makes you where you don't want it anymore.
And I'm trying to think of what the specific medication is that they sometimes prescribe to alcoholics. And while on that medication, if they drink, they get sick as a dog.
Really? Still today they do it?
They do it with some alcoholics, yes.
Huh.
And I've known some alcoholics, though they got sick as a dog, they still drank. That's hardcore bad.
That is
hardcore bad. But basically, when the addict is in this cycle, because it is reinforcing itself, and some of it's based on, yeah, some people are more genetically predisposed, hard word for me to say, predisposed there. There's also a lot of it that is not genetic, but it is still familiar.
Okay.
What I mean is that children of alcoholics are more likely to become alcoholics than non-people because it's a behavior that they saw in their own household.
Yeah. And they probably had access to alcohol earlier than most people.
Exactly.
Yeah. You
know. The other thing is were there addictive traits developed? Let's give you a classic example. Joe, who starts drinking at 16 and goes through college drinking like a fish.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just drinking all the time. But then when he gets married, decides I need to straighten up my life and stops and quits. Well, for Joe, drinking was never that core providing that sense of safety that it might have been for Bill.
Gotcha.
Because Joe didn't grow up in a household of constant chronic stress. Joe didn't grow up with maybe a whole lot of insecurities, a whole lot of fears. And because of that, drinking was chemically altering his behavior and it was altering his mind, and quitting's going to cause him problems because he's still going to have some physical, you know, DTs and things like that, perhaps with drinking. But it didn't have that same addictive connection because it didn't meet that same need that it did for Bill, who grew up in that home of constant chronic stress, was always in stress. His body and his limbic system were on red alert all the time because of this.
Yeah,
and alcohol became that relief that so satisfied that, you know, immediate relief from that constant chronic stress.
Yeah.
It's going to be much harder for him to quit his addiction because it's not physical.
Yeah.
He can get the alcohol out of his system and get all the, you know, all the side effects out of his system. And there is still, when he's confronted with anxiety and stress, unless that brain has not rewired itself during that time, wanting to drink is what he wants to do.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just because that's been his coping mechanism for forever.
Yeah. Well, I'd mentioned before in the show that I'd had an issue with drinking years ago, and but it wasn't hard for me to quit.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, I mean, obviously that was probably why. I drank for fun. I drank when I played golf with my buddies. I drank at night when I got home, but it was just because, I don't know. I don't even know why I did it. But whenever my daughters were born and I realized it was not going to be good to be, you know, that was the main reason that I quit, because my girls, I didn't want them to grow up around that. And so I just put it down one day and really never picked it up again. I mean, it's just, and now it's just not even on my radar. It's not even something I'm interested in, you know, but it wasn't hard. I mean, to quit, I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was really going to struggle. So did my wife. She was like, You're never going to be able to quit. And I was like, you know, I think I can. And I did. I mean, it was just.
Right.
You know, but.
And that's the other thing that, you know, oftentimes people who don't struggle with addiction, why don't you just quit? I was able to quit.
Right, right.
And again, they don't understand, you know, that it's different for some people. Yeah. And, you know, that's one of the things that is, again, about the addiction that a lot of people don't understand. It's not the neurochemical, physiological aspect of the addiction that is so controlling. It's that survival mechanism, psychological dependence that is at such a deep level in the brain that oftentimes at the beginning people don't even realize it.
Yeah. And speaking to the audience real quick, I don't want anybody to think I'm patting myself on the back or you know, I could just maybe hear somebody who might be struggling saying, well, good for you. You quit. I mean, I didn't mean to come across that way, but, you know, I know that.
Because
you know,
it's true. Some people are able to quit cold turkey.
Yeah.
Some people are able to walk away from it, whether it be alcohol, whether it be marijuana, whether it be cigarettes, that's probably the number one addiction in the United States that nobody talks about is nicotine.
Yeah.
Because it's illegal, and therefore, you know, everybody thinks, well, that's okay.
Right.
How much money do people spend on cigarettes? It's a different rabbit to chase, but
it is still an addiction, though.
For the hardcore alcoholic.
Yeah.
Okay. Now that the alcohol is basically in control of his life, what choice is he making anymore?
None.
That's right. He's not.
Yeah.
Even when he thinks he's making choices, it's really the alcohol that's making choices for him. I'll give you a classic example. The alcoholic who decides to move, and he makes up all these reasons why he's moving. It's closer to work. We don't need this house this big. We're downsizing. Oh, the real reason he's moving is because he's paying $1,200 a month where he is. This new place is for $800 a month, which clears up $400 more a month that he can drink with every month.
Wow.
Now, at a conscious level, he would never admit that.
Yeah.
But that's what's happening. The alcohol is really driving that behavior. The addiction is driving that behavior.
And he's giving himself for something that works. The idea of, well, I'm doing this to save money and be closer to work and all this. And he knows that. And so he's able to use that as a, because nobody, who can argue with that? You're right. That's a great idea. To move closer to work and save money. But
it all sounds like it makes sense.
Right.
And he probably at some point in his head is thinking it makes sense. But at the end of the month, he doesn't have any more money paying, you know, $600 less or $400 less a month than what he was. Because it's just going to the alcohol.
Yeah, now he's drunker.
He's just drunker now. This is what happens, and as this occurs, and fewer decisions are being made, fewer and fewer choices are being made, and as the addiction is making decisions for the person, he begins to move into survival mode. And decisions in survival mode are not made by what's good or bad. They're not made by what's right or wrong. Survival mode decisions are made on the basis of two things and two things only. Number one, what can keep me alive? And number two, how can I satisfy my addiction? And that's the only thing that is driving behavior. So this is something that I saw 100 times in the past. You have somebody, you know, no matter how bad it gets, no matter how bad my addiction gets, I will never steal from my parents so that I can go use. And then 7 months later, what have they done?
Stole from their parents.
Exactly right. They know it's wrong.
Yeah.
But when they're operating in survival mode, right and wrong is not guiding their behavior at that point.
Or taking their wife's wedding ring to the pawn shop.
It's exactly right.
Yeah.
Whatever I do, I will not pawn my stuff
to
buy money for drugs. And the next thing you know, they're pawning off their stuff to buy money for drugs.
You know, and it was I worked in a pawn shop for a while, off and on over the years. I know some people that own some pawn shops, and I've worked for them. It's been a while, but you could tell when people came in whether or not they were needing to pay an electric bill or whether or not they were needing it for drugs or alcohol. You could tell.
Oh, yeah.
By the way that they were, how desperate they were. I mean, you know, but it seems like the people that, now I'm just assuming here, so I mean, but you could tell, you know, that it's kind of a hard thing to say, but the desperation seemed way more with the people that were doing it for an addiction than it did for the people that were doing it just to pay a bill or buy some gas or whatever they were trying to do.
I'm on Facebook, and I joke because I'm friends with a lot of former guys who stayed at the Mission on Facebook.
Yeah.
And one of the ways I try to keep up with guys, and you know, there's some guys out there that are doing great. They post on a regular basis. You can tell they're doing great in their recovery by what they're posting on Facebook.
Yeah.
But I can usually tell when someone's
slipped off the wagon.
Yes, because suddenly they go dark on Facebook. You know, yeah. They don't make a post, and you know, they just suddenly disappear.
Yeah.
The other one is they're starting to sell everything.
Yeah.
And that's usually uh-oh.
Or they post something crazy at like 2 o'clock in the morning. Nobody loves me.
No, that's the phone call you get.
Yeah,
no kidding. I love you so much.
Yeah, no kidding.
But as survival mode continues,
yeah,
and this thinking has basically deteriorated by this point, because since they're not making decisions, the drug of choice is making those decisions for them, and since they've already compromised what's right and wrong because the only thing that matters is satisfying their addiction, oftentimes that they come out of their addiction, and even when they're clean, their thinking process is unbelievably distorted. Mm. They haven't made choices for themselves, so they don't know how to make choices for themselves. Sometimes when they make choices, they think they're making good choices, but they're really not, because their ability to choose has been so compromised that they really struggle to do what's right. And I had a friend in recovery years ago say this, and I thought, man, how good it is. He said, "My mind is like a bad neighborhood at night." He said, "If I go in there by myself thinking this is not going to be trouble, I'm setting myself up for trouble."
Yeah.
But what he was admitting to is his thinking had gotten so distorted through the years, and he was still having to figure out how to think in a right way. And, you know, from a neurological look at addiction, what he's having to do is he's having to rewire the brain, make those new neural connections, rewire the way we think so that we're learning healthier ways to respond to anxiety, to stress, to fear,
yeah,
so that we're breaking those cycles.
Well, I was just going to say, when it comes to the rewiring, to that process that they have mm-hmm. to go through, have you been able to identify like any kind of a time frame of this sort of thing? I mean, are we talking about, does it take them like a year to come up with, like, to try to flush all that out and kind of rewire? I mean, I know that's kind of a broad question. It's different for everyone, and it's kind of hard to nail that down. But, I mean, we're not talking weeks here. We're talking, like,
right,
long periods of time, I mean, right, to do this.
We are. And, yeah, you know, this is a very biblical idea. Romans 12:2. Do not be conformed to the patterns of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Yes. I mean, that's a very biblical concept. What I used to tell guys at the mission is it's usually around 12 months. In fact, I used to tell people it's the 6 month to 12 month window that is really, really, really dangerous for an addict in recovery.
Yeah.
And this is the reason why. When I've been using for years and years and years, when a person's been, you know, strung out on alcohol or drugs or whatever their addiction is, you know, we're talking alcohol and drugs. Gambling is a real addiction in the United States. Pornography is a real addiction in the United States. Eating disorders are a huge untalked about addiction in the United States.
Yeah.
The fastest growing addiction in the United States is technology addiction.
Yeah.
And all you got to do is look at teenagers who stay on their phone for 12 hours a day.
Right.
And you understand that that can be a real issue.
Yeah.
And with
adults too.
Yeah. And with the technology issue, especially with kids, it's unbelievably dangerous.
Yeah.
Because kids who are gaining their self-image from TikTok and from Twitter and from all these, you know, other social media platforms, that can be a very dangerous thing.
Yeah.
But when someone gets clean, being clean feels great.
Yeah.
I mean, when you can wake up in the morning and remember what you did the night before.
Yeah.
When you can, you know, actually go a whole day without craving to use. When you can make it through, you know, the whole day healthy and feeling good. You know, you start, you know, eating right, you start exercising, being clean feels wonderful. And it feels so wonderful that most addicts don't, and most addicts who get clean don't think about using for at least 4 or 5 months because feeling clean is so great.
Yeah, feels so good, yeah.
If an addict has been clean and stayed clean for at least a year, there's a good chance they've learned the things they need to do to maintain their recovery. So it's that 6 month to 12 month window when the new car smell is worn off, so to speak.
Yeah.
They're now starting to deal with more things that create anxiety and stress and fear and all these other things. And they haven't quite totally developed those new coping skills to take care of those things. To me, that's the big danger window. Hmm. And if you watch, this is the pattern that you see also, because guys get clean. It's great. It's wonderful. They get a 30-day, you know, detox program or something like that. They come home. It's great. It's wonderful. They get back in with their spouse. They get back into their job. Everything's going good. 6 months down the road, 8 months down the road, boom. There's, you know, relapse. They're right back in it. It's, you know, and the cycle goes on again and again and again. And it's usually in that 6 to 12 month window that everything falls apart.
Yeah.
And that's because, yeah, they've gotten clean. But again, they haven't developed the things they need to develop. And this is difficult because being transformed by the renewing of your mind, it does not happen overnight. Mm, yeah. And, you know, and this is in all aspects of life. I had two guys outside my door one day, they were cussing a blue streak.
Whoa.
I mean, every other word was F this effing thing and all of this. And, you know, I'm sure they didn't know I could hear, but I was just hearing every word they said. So I just said, hey, guys, you know, watch the language. Okay, Okay. Well, one of them came to me about 2 hours later and said, I really do want to apologize. But he said, you need to understand, that's the only language I know. I've talked like that my whole life.
Yeah.
And I said, I understand. You know, that's why you're here trying to break that pattern. And, you know, this is why I use the book of Exodus to tell this story. This is the Israelites out in the wilderness. They've been set free. God has delivered them from their alcohol and drugs, or their bondage, not their alcohol and drugs, but right. God has delivered them from their bondage to the Egyptians. And here they are from sunrise to sunset coming to Moses with every single small, tiny issue they've got because they still don't know how to think for themselves.
Yeah, they need that.
And here they are not long after that, just been given the Ten Commandments. Pretty important. They've just been told the things that they should not do. Moses goes up on the mountain. We don't know how long he's going to be. Make for us a God that we can worship and see and touch with our own eyes. And here they are. You know, it's been less than 2 months since, Moses, if Moses was on the mountain for 40 days, it's been about 42 days, somewhere in there. It hadn't been long. And here they are. They're already going back to what, you know, what they knew. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, this is one of the things that I think addicts really struggle with because they don't understand how compromised their thinking has become.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's things that church members, sometimes family members, friends don't understand how compromised their thinking has become also. Because when you have a conversation with them, they still know everything. Because it's not about their knowledge. It's about their decision-making process. And the decision-making process didn't happen for years. Or when it happened, it was driven solely by their drug of choice.
Wow.
So now, when they're making their own decisions, it becomes more challenging. And, you know, I talk with addicts about this. You know, what were the things that you enjoyed doing before you started using? Some of them have already forgotten them.
Wow.
Or I'll tell them, if they'll tell me the things they enjoyed doing, like one of them said, well, I really enjoyed hunting before I started using. How many times did you hunt when you were in full-blown addiction? None.
Yeah, zero.
Why spend time hunting? You know, I was always going to spend, okay, well, if hunting's something you used to enjoy, this may be something that you want to see if you can, you know, start doing once again. Because yeah, this was something that brought you some joy, and because you get clean and, okay, now what do I do?
Yeah.
What do I do for fun? What do I do when I'm frustrated? What do I do when I'm happy? What do I do when I'm sad? Because the answer to every one of those questions in their addiction was, well, I use. You know, yeah, that's just it. So, you know, having to make choices, learning, and sometimes relearning the decision-making process is the challenge. It's not knowledge. It's not that they lost the ability to, you know, do simple math or even complex, you know, physics. You know, some addicts I've known have been unbelievably intelligent, you know, extremely intelligent.
Yeah.
So it's not a knowledge issue. It's the process of how do I choose what I want to do.
Yeah.
That's what they lost, because they went for years without doing that consciously. And if they don't learn it, one of two things is going to happen. First, you're going to get into the idle mind is a devil's workshop area.
Right.
Because they've got free time on their hands and they do not know what to do with it.
And money, probably.
And if they got money on their hands and they do not know what to do with it as well, yeah, those become very serious issues that can lead them back into addiction. I mean, and guys relapse because they're bored.
Yeah.
But they're bored because they don't know how to make choices.
Yeah.
And since they don't know how to make choices when they have free time, they don't have a clue what to do with it.
That's scary.
Yes, it can be scary. But the other issue is, and again, this is decision-making and thinking, what are healthy choices to make when I start to feel stressed? What are healthy choices to make when I start to feel anxiety?
Yeah.
Who do I talk to? Who do I go to? Who do I ask for help? Since maybe my decision-making isn't as good as it needs to be right now, who are the people in my life that I'm going to bounce my ideas off of? I'll give you a classic example of this. Okay.
Okay.
So I'm going to use Bob again. Bob's my go-to name when I'm telling a story. But Bob, he's clean from his alcohol and drugs. And Bob now is reconnecting with his family. And because Bob is clean and reconnecting with his family, you know, he and his wife are getting back together. And, of course, you know, they're now going to, you know, do the joint paycheck, joint bills, all of that other good kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But right before Bob and his wife get back together, he gets his income money back. So Bob puts savings accounts to the checking account. And he doesn't tell his wife. Now, in Bob's mind, there's a very simple reason he's doing this.
What's that?
He's saving it for a rainy day.
Oh, of course.
You know, he got a little money in the savings account in a reserve. So if the car breaks down, get some money in reserve. If we, you know, need a new refrigerator or dishwasher, got some money in reserve. That's exactly in Bob's mind why he's saving it. But when Bob was in active addiction, what was one of the things he always did? He hid money, because using cost money, and the only way to keep it hidden from your family is to hide it.
Yeah.
Play a little shell game with it. So, you know, you get that income tax money back and you put it over in the savings account instead of the checking account. So she never knows that Bob has it. And so Bob is telling himself the whole time, I'm just saving it. So if the car breaks down or if the, you know, he's telling himself all the time the reason he's saving it.
Well, it's also so he can tell her if she catches him.
Yes, exactly. He can tell her if she catches him.
No, baby, now, I'm just putting that in there just in case.
Now, of course, what this is, he doesn't know it consciously, but that's his using money.
Yeah.
And it's his stash for using. Now, there's nothing wrong with Bob putting that money in the savings account. But that was the addict mind telling him to do that without talking to his wife.
Yeah.
And that's where he has to learn, this is not a healthy decision. I have money that I hid from people.
Yeah.
Having money that people do not know about has always been bad news for me. It's never worked before. I am repeating a pattern that has got me in trouble in the past. Bob doesn't see any of that at that point in his life because he does not realize how compromised his decision-making process is. In his mind, it makes perfect sense that he's doing that. That's this thing that has to be rebuilt. This is where this learning has to take place. This is where the need for accountability has to take place. Same situation, but this time Bob says, hey, honey, I got this income money come in, and you know, I want to save this. I don't want to put it in our checking account. I want to save it in case, you know, we do have something break down. That's great. Even better yet, hey, honey, we've got this income money this income tax money that just came in. I want to save this so that if something goes wrong and we need, you know, a car repair or something like that, then we'll have that money set aside. But I want you to put it in a savings account that my name's not on.
Yeah.
Even better.
Yeah, right. That's actually doing what he should be doing.
Right.
Yeah, you know, the actual.
So, but this is where the addict is when he comes straight out of his addiction. He's not made choices. The drug of choice has made choices for him. Mm. His decision-making is compromised because of that, and it's often poor. Poor decision-making is something, but he doesn't realize it.
Yeah.
He thinks his decision-making is fine. That's one of the things that has to be rebuilt for the addict to be able to live in his recovery. And that's about, one, rediscovering who he is as a person. What are his likes? What are his dislikes? It's about building accountability with others so that I'm talking with others and having them share my ideas. Because, like I said, in my mind, it was a great idea.
Yeah.
But if I had told that to somebody else would say, no, that's a really stupid idea.
Don't do that.
So, you know, it's all of these things that the addict in recovery needs to be learning. And hey, at one point he's going to rebuild his decision making process. At one point he's going to be able to make good choices, healthy choices, right choices.
Yeah.
Okay. Again, and you're going back to the story of the Israelites. When they first approach the land of Canaan, they panic. Mm-hmm. What is the decision they come up with that's their great way to solve not going into the promised land and facing these giants?
Sending Joshua in there.
No. After Joshua goes in there and they come back with
Report. He goes over and finds the giants and stuff. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right.
At that point, their great decision, okay, promised land's ahead of us, but it's got a whole lot of giants in it, and we're not sure we can defeat them. So I got an idea. Let's go back to Egypt. That makes sense to them.
Yeah.
Because their decision making is so compromised.
Yeah.
Now compare that to, you know, several years later when they enter the promised land, or actually when they get on the edge of the promised land and they're about to enter it. And I love this line because after God appears to Joshua and tells Joshua, look, Moses is dead, now it's your turn to lead, and he just reinforces this idea over and over and over again, be strong and courageous. Well, then the people come to Joshua and tell him the same thing, be strong and courageous. So the people have now decided, we can do this. With God's help, we can enter the promised land. With God's help, we can defeat the giants that are in the land. With God's help, we can live in our freedom. So they've changed their decision-making process during their time in the wilderness. It's really important because that's the process that has to take place in an addict's life for him to be able to live in the promised land, or just like the Israelites, when he meets his giants, and everybody in recovery is going to meet their giants. Their mind is going to say, I know how we deal with this. Let's go back to using.
Yeah.
And it actually, in some ways, makes sense to them at that time.
Yeah.
I'm just going to use once. I just need a little bravery, just need a liquid courage, and that'll be all I need to deal with this issue.
Yeah, I'll be fine right after this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I just gonna take one little hit, because one little hit will, you know, give me the energy to solve this problem. You know, that their brain starts to find ways to make what they're doing make sense when it is totally destructive behavior. Because they got a broken brain.
Yeah.
And this is what recovery is about, is learning, okay, yeah, you're clean. That's wonderful. But you still think like a junkie.
Yep.
And that's what has to change. And the fact that you're clean is great. We want to celebrate that. But we want to remember that what you lost in your bondage, you have to once again repair.
Yeah.
And that does not happen overnight.
Wow. So anyway, that's the idea we wanted to get across to you tonight, talking about the loss of thinking like that. That's something that gets missed, I think, a lot in addiction and recovery. Rusty, did you want to add anything else before we close up?
Well, one, I did want to say that detox programs understand this, because a detox program, 30-day detox program, will tell you, we got you clean. They're not going to tell you that you're ready to go out there and, you know, conquer the world. What they're probably going to tell you is go to 90 meetings in 90 days.
Yeah.
Find a 12-step meeting and go for 90 days straight.
Yeah.
And then the 12-step meeting is probably going to tell you, hey, you don't have to come every day now, but you probably need to come once a week, twice a week for a while. And again, this is because this takes time.
Yeah.
And the other thing I'd like to add, look, we got a Facebook page. You got questions?
Yeah.
Send them our way. We'll try to either answer them by writing back to you.
Yep.
Or if we can answer them on the podcast, we'll do that as well.
Absolutely. So, yeah, just hit us up on Facebook and put your questions in there, and phone numbers, anything else that you want us to contact, email, however you want to do that. And we'll get back with you and see if we can't help give you a good answer to some of these questions. But okay, so that's it for this evening, and we'll see you guys next week.
All right, guys, let's go ahead and pray. God, thank you for this evening. Thank you, God, for everyone who will listen to this podcast. God, I pray that those who need to hear it, God, that this will reach their ears. God, just continue to guide us. We want to be on mission for you, so just continue to watch over us in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Good night, everybody.